Remember when we played hoops in Brett's backyard?
Yes.
And I showed off my 3-inch vertical. It's basically like that.
I'm gonna put this out there on the record. Do you remember when I dunked a lot?
Off-season, a baseball prospectus daily podcast focusing solely on Fantasy Keeper and Dynasty League formats. I am your host, Ben Carsley of the BP Fantasy Team, and I'm joined by BP's managing editor, Brett Sayer, and BP's minor league editor, Craig Goldstein. Good evening, gentlemen. Brett, are you having a better or worse week than the Rays?
I am having a much better week than the Rays.
Craig, are you having a better or worse week than people who are trying to tell us that what the Rays are doing is smart?
I'm at like a Marco Rubio at this town hall level right now. I'm looking for, it's like a bad week, but I'm looking for credit just for showing up.
So, but you're pretty sweaty right now?
Yeah. I'm reaching for the water.
Yeah, that's fair. That's to be expected. So, welcome to the second of what I'm sure will be at least another 100 episodes of Tina. We are going to discuss the top 101 Dynasty Prospects list this edition, which came out just about a week ago today on Baseball Prospectus. I'm sure if you're listening to this podcast, you already know the drill, but just real quick, this is the second year in a row that our final 101 has sort of been a collaborative list. Brett and I each rank a 101. We see where the chips fall, and then we sort of talk through any major differences. And then the last 10 or so guys are just people we like. But a little bit unique, I think, compared to a lot of other dynasty lists you see, because it is very much the brainchild of two people and not just one. Although, given how often Brett and I agreed this year, maybe that's not entirely true. Maybe it's like one and a half people. But since Brett and I are the ones who wrote this, we are going to let Craig sort of steer us through it. And Craig, please don't ask about Jesse Winker, but otherwise the floor is yours.
Oh, thank you. I'm going to start before the rankings, because Ben, I recall going back from Dynasty Dynamics articles with you that we both hate intros, but you wrote this one, correct?
I did.
I actually thought it was a really good intro because it talks about kind of the echo chamber that we end up in, which certainly is something that's present on this podcast, and kind of a little bit about how you and Brett have different opinions on more of a select few players than you know, I don't know. I guess you expect it to, like you said, you expect to go in with a bunch of differences, and it turned out it was more of a select few. What you said in terms of resolving that was you get on the phone or hop on GChat and hash it out. But I guess my question for either of you or both of you would be, what does hashing it out look like? Like what do you dig into when you dig into a prospect to figure out, you know, where you're comfortable with and, you know, where you're comfortable ranking them? And like, is it a compromise where you're both unhappy? Like, do you stand your ground? I'm sure it's different on different people, but kind of how does that work?
Yeah.
Because I think it's useful for people.
So from my perspective, there are two different, actually there are three different types of ways we resolve it. Number one is, one of us didn't know something about a prospect that the other person did. So sometimes it's as simple as sort of, you know, Brett saying, hey, this guy is 2 years older. Did you, like, you know, this guy's already 24 and maybe I thought he was 22 and just missed that. And then I'm like, oh, okay. Or we're comparing two players and I'm like, well, Brett, this guy already did it in high A compared to this guy in low A. And he's like, okay. So sometimes it's just unearthing something that you know, we overlooked or maybe we didn't know. So that's pretty easy to resolve, because usually the person who didn't know will sort of just come around to the other person's thinking. The second type is more of a barter, where it's like, hey, I really want to rank Franklin Barreto here. You know, if we bump Mackenzie Gore up 10 spots, can you live with that? So the other one is more of a sort of classic, just negotiation, as long as you can live with it. And then if we're really stuck, we'll just take the average, frankly. Anything I missed, Brett?
No, I think that's a good description at the beginning. I think, you know, we also tweak once we start doing the write-ups. And I think some of that is when we, you know, a lot of the stuff that we put in the article is easy for us to then use as back and forth to move up or down. So, you know, we talk about the, you know, the ETAs, and we talk about the, you know, the dollar upsides and all of that. And once that starts getting entered in, it just kind of, you know, they become conversation points. And, you know, we had this conversation, right? What was the conversation about Adrian Morjon this year, right? Mm-hmm. Where that was a good conversation where I had filled in a particular risk factor and dollar amount, and you were like, I don't know if this looks right. And then we talked it out, and you were right, and we changed it. And yeah, I think that conversation is extremely helpful in making the list that we end up making.
Yeah. And I'd say you and I are also, even if we're not always on the same page about exact ranking, we're almost always on the same page about grouping. So it's very rare that, you know, we would disagree that someone should be lumped with other players of a similar type or something like that. So it's pretty easy for us to navigate that way.
Mm-hmm. So the second part of this is, I mentioned echo chamber, and it's something that you mentioned, Ben, and that, you know, when you say that you're on the same page so much, and I think the three of us often kind of agree with, you know, kind of more slight differences than complete disagreements. So obviously we want people reading our articles and listening to our podcast, and we appreciate everyone who's like a died through BP person, but, you know, we do have an echo chamber, and I guess, you know, certainly you guys formulate this list without my particular input at all. And I'm, you know, I chime in later as kind of a separate voice, but even the three of us agree a lot. So I guess my question is, like, for people who actually listen to our advice and listen to our podcast and read the site, like, how much do they have to worry about that in terms of skewing them? You know, obviously they respect our opinions, but, and I'm not saying they should go read, you know, another site if they don't value it as much, but like, how do we address that issue, Brett? Like the echo chamber issue. I mean, it's something you talked about when you talked about your team for RDI and stuff like that. So like, how do we go about internally addressing this thing where we talk ourselves into circles on certain players and stuff like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing is sort of identifying where those areas lie in your analysis, in your rankings. And, you know, I think all three of us are pretty good at kind of noticing where the three of us tend to gravitate towards, since we've been doing this for quite a while now. So I think, you know, I think it kind of walks the line now between an echo chamber and you know, and a fluid, you know, opinion about how we see value of these types of players. So I don't think I think it's kind of healthy where it is now, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. I don't worry about it being unhealthy.
Yeah. And I think the most important thing is just be upfront about it, right? Like I make fun of myself for liking, you know, hit and run first middle infielders all the time. Brett always makes fun of himself for liking big beefy corner boys. You know, we acknowledge that we're super low on pitchers. So as long as you say those things often enough and make them really clear, I think people can make the adjustments themselves.
Yeah. And I will say, just, obviously I asked a question, but I do think, you know, we get new people into the fantasy team every year. And, you know, we have email discussions about different rankings and people present different point of views. It's not always one we agree with, but so on some level though, we are exposed to other opinions, even within the BP team. But okay. So, So let's get to the actual list. You guys have at no, there's no surprise, but Acuña and Victor Robles are 1 and 2. You included in tier one potential, which you labeled potential 1-1 picks, Vladimir Guerrero Jr. How much of an uphill fight does he have, given that he's not going to be a factor in stolen bases?
I don't think it's that much of an uphill. I don't think it's that much of an uphill battle at all, and that's how dominant he could be in batting average and power down the road. I think that if he steals 10 bases, it'll be a really good year for him. I don't think there's anyone on the list who has the same batting average potential, and there's really only a handful of people that have more power potential, especially with his, you know, his hit tool and his ability to tap into it.
Okay. Ben, I'll just ask you, like, is there anything on these three guys that you think needs to be discussed that kind of hasn't been already? I mean, I think they get a lot of attention as is.
No, I don't think so. I would just say, I guess Robles is maybe a little, not underrated, but he's not as sexy a name as Acuña or Guerrero, but he's right there with them. Just don't forget about him.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's, you know, it might be a smaller chance, but there is a chance he gets, like, to average game power, and if he does, it's a really valuable overall package. Okay, so the next tier you have was 1.5, so obviously not even a full step back of these guys, future fantasy franchise cornerstones. You have Brendan Rodgers at number 4. I think this is both reasonable in one sense, given that he's a young shortstop who can really hit and is in the Rockies system. I think on the flip side of that is there are concerns about his walk rate and his approach at the plate. I guess how did you go about balancing that, Ben? Like, how much are you concerned about Brendan Rodgers and his approach at the plate?
Yeah, I'm not yet. He was just, we've talked about it before, he was too good for his own good at high A. I don't know how you criticize someone for their, like, what was he supposed to do? Not hit 400? You know what I mean? Walk more,
right, so yeah,
hit 400?
Yeah, 387.
Yeah, exactly. So, will I be more concerned if I don't see any improvement this year? Yes, but, you know, Double A was a very, very aggressive assignment for him last year. I know that that Lancaster is a bit of a joke, but what he did there sort of transcends the typical Lancaster stat line. And the overall upside is huge. I mean, it is a little bit of a lazy comparison, but I really do think he could be prime Tulo with maybe not quite as much speed. And I know you and I have disagreed on this before, and I agree that he's a better bet to have real impact in 2019, but I don't think it's out of the question that he works his way into that infield in the second half of 2018 either. So I have no problem with him anywhere in this tier. If you want to put him behind the rest of this tier, that's totally cool. But I do think there's a difference between Rodgers and guys in the next tier down.
Yeah, I think that's reasonable. I do think 2019 is much more likely, but overall, obviously pretty reasonable. Brett, how do you balance? So this tier is Rodgers, Jimenez, Eloy Jimenez, Gleyber Torres, and Fernando Tatis Jr. How do you balance the seeming safety over ceiling that someone like Gleyber offers compared to, you know, I think Tatis and Eloy especially have kind of this higher ceiling, at least feeling to them. Is it shortchanging Gleyber's ceiling in terms of fantasy? Or, yeah, I don't know. I'm just going to leave it there.
I think it is, and I think, you know, I think it's kind of a lesson that we might be taking away from the Francisco Lindor breakout, which is a good lesson in that, you know, we really liked Lindor, and we were still, you know, everyone was hesitant on him. I think we were probably a little bit higher on him than most, but we did not foresee this kind of ceiling. And now that it is here, I mean, it really all starts. It starts with the hit tool, and it starts with the baseball IQ and just the natural feel for the game. And Torres has all of that. And that's certainly not to say that he's going to have Lindor type upside, but I wouldn't rule out him having more upside than we might think at this point.
Do you think a lot of that applies to the guy who's at the top of the next year in Nick Senzel?
Yeah, Senzel, I think is another really good example of that. You know, he's pretty much everything you want in an infield prospect. You know, a non first base infield prospect. You know,
he's going to be. They're trotting him out at shortstop now.
They are. I don't buy that. But God bless him. I just think that, you know, he's just such a good natural hitter. And with that park, I mean, even if he is just naturally a 20 home run guy, he could hit 25 plus in that park, even if he doesn't improve on that. So you're talking about someone who can steal bases, who can really do everything. And, you know, I think we get caught up a lot in the big homer numbers and the big steal numbers, but those all around contributors are extremely valuable for fantasy.
Yeah, and he's someone, you know, I think I'm becoming more of a high person on a guy like Senzel, who I've been down on before. But you know, when you slug whatever it was at 550 in the Florida, I think it was in the Florida State League, it might have been in Double A. I mean, that's real power. You know, I don't know if he's someone who needs to lift more, but in that park, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if he produced more power than kind of was anticipated, at least in his earlier days as a prospect. Brad, I want to stick with you for a little bit, because Shohei Ohtani's the next guy at number 9, and obviously you're the guy who deals with a lot of the players coming over from foreign leagues, but you have him as a potential earnings 30 to 35. Like, so my question there is how did you arrive at that number? And it's not because I disagree with it, but I think it's a complicated thing, given his flexibility.
Yeah, it is really complicated, and it also gets more complicated because it depends on where your league is housed.
Yeah.
So I mean, if you are you know, there are no leagues right now that are kind of counting him with both stats at the same time, which would obviously make him a lot more valuable. But if you are able to switch him back and forth, you know, that also makes him a little bit more valuable. Personally, the $30 to $35 comes from the fact that I think he's going to be a really good pitcher, and I think the hitting stuff will gradually fall to the wayside a little bit. I don't really see him getting more than 300 at bats in a season. And, you know, maybe that is shortchanging him a little bit, but I don't see it at the moment. And, I think he's going to be a good enough pitcher that they're just not going to mess with his development on the mound that much.
So I guess here's my other question, and I'm gonna it's probably putting you on the spot, but it relates to guys in this tier as well, like Alex Reyes is a potential earnings $30 to $35 guy as well. Who are the pitchers, for example, just so we get a sense of what tier this puts them in, who are the pitchers who were $30 to $35 pitchers this year?
Pretty much the four aces, and then Steven Strasburg, and I think two other guys just snuck into the $30 to $35 range. So you're talking about fewer than 10 pitchers that earned $35.
Okay. So and you, for Ohtani, just to reiterate, you think the bulk of that is coming from his pitching?
Yeah, I think that's
how you arrived at the kind of more of this figure.
Exactly. I think 90% of it is from his hitting, from his pitching. Okay. Sorry.
Okay, and Ben, are you kind of on board with that, or what was your take on Ohtani?
My take on Ohtani was I was going to let Brett handle it.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense.
It's pretty close to where I had him too.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Okay, so I don't want to go player by player forever. I usually stop around the top 10. We're right around there. The number 10 is Kyle Tucker. I think it's a ranking that makes sense to me, but he's not someone I feel like that gets talked up as much. He's kind of more, I don't know, like everyone acknowledges he's good, but I don't know, there's not a ton of hype around Kyle Tucker. Am I making that up, Ben? Or like, is he underrated at this point?
I don't know if I have a sense of if he's underrated in Dynasty as a whole. I think that he's not talked about as much because the tools aren't as flashy, and also because he's not the great savior of his franchise, right? He's not going to have the expectations that someone like an Acuna or maybe like an Eloy or a Vlad Guerrero have. He's just going to be another good player in a crazy good lineup. And I think guys like that sometimes tend to get a little bit overlooked. But I think he has a wonderful ceiling and floor sort of combination, because it's difficult for me to imagine him not hitting at all. So then you're just wondering how much the power shows up and whether he can, you know, swipe 10 bags a year or whatever for his first few seasons. But I can't really imagine him failing to be at least like an OF4.
But so let me put it another way. Would you be happy to have him as your number one prospect in your system? Like if you're in a fantasy, you know, in a TDGX type league or maybe, you know, somewhere between 16 and 20 teams.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously you'd prefer one of the guys ahead of him, but especially if I needed to compete soon, I think he'd be a wonderful first prospect.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, so it's a little bit of a dumb question because you ranked him 10th, right? And if you're in a 16-team league, so I realize it's a dumb question, but I do feel like, again, and maybe this is just my perception, it's off, but like people, I don't know, I feel like people are just like, yeah, he's fine. Like he's definitely good, but it's not exciting. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that's probably fair.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm gonna skip around a little bit. At 15 and 16, you have Bo Bichette and Juan Soto. Actually, you know what? I'm just gonna keep going. At 17, you have Hura, 18 Florial, 19 Robert. So that's five guys. Ben, if you, out of those five guys, who do you think ranks highest next year?
So one of the questions I've gotten the most this ranking season is, you know, who could be the next Acuna? Who's the guy who could go from, wow, he's pretty interesting, to, you know, 1-1 ranking next year? And for me, it's Soto. I'm a little worried that won't happen just because we know that hamate injuries can linger. He might not show the power we want him to show this year. But if he does, you know, I expect Acuna to graduate. I expect Robles to graduate. So you're probably looking at a battle between Soto, Guerrero, maybe Brandon Rogers, maybe Fernando Tatis. So out of this group, I think Soto's the guy who has the best odds of being 1-1.
Brett, do you have are you on Soto the same way or someone else?
I'm going to go in a slightly different direction. I think Soto is absolutely the guy who has the best chance of being in the top five. In terms of being number one, I think it's Luis Robert. I think he could come out in his pro debut and really just blow up the lower minors. I think they're probably, did they announce where they're going to start him? They're probably going to start him in high A.
I'm not sure that they've announced it.
That would be my guess, is that they would start him in high A, and I think he could just destroy it and be up in double A by the second half of the season. I mean, he doesn't have stateside pro experience yet, but he was really good in the Cuban League at a really young age. And he's got the five category skill set that you would ideally want to see in a number one prospect. So yeah, if I had to shoot for someone to be 1-1, it might be him. Yeah.
Okay. So let me see. I'm trying to figure out how to phrase the question, but what, how different, Brett, is Willie Calhoun from Vladimir Guerrero, like in a fantasy sense? And I know obviously there's an age difference there, but I guess my mindset here is extremely good hitters. There's real, you know, hit for average, hit for power. So what is the difference there? I mean, obviously there is a difference, but how substantial is it?
I think the difference is in just the sheer quality of the hit tool. You know, I don't think there is another hit tool in the minors that you can really compare to Vlad's. I mean, his contact rate for his age was absolutely ridiculous. I mean, Calhoun is a really good hitter.
Calhoun doesn't really strike out either.
He doesn't really strike out. He's 286 career average in the minors, and that's not something to, you know, put a ton of stock behind. But, you know, I have a feeling that Vlad is the kind of hitter that might end up being a 330 hitter in the minors before he gets to the majors. And I think that kind of hints at the difference there. I think in terms of power, I think they're similar. In terms of tapping into the power, I think they're similar. But I think Vlad's contact ability is just completely out of control.
Ben, I'm going to ask you about a guy I've long liked, and I think I'm a little surprised at how high he was. And I know he's a guy that both of you agreed on, but Ryan McMahon checks in at 27th. I'm a little surprised he's this high, because it hasn't been the smoothest path for him. So kind of what drove this ranking? I mean, it's a lot of respect for a guy who hasn't done. I mean, he's likely to be in the majors this year, obviously, but it's a crowded infield to a certain degree, and like I said, he's had some ups and downs.
He has had ups and downs, but as of late, they've been definitely way more ups. Because it was, what, the first half of 2016 when he looked like he was just not really a prospect anymore, and then turned it on late. And last year was really quite good. And what for me is the most encouraging about last year is it's not like the numbers were better, but the approach stayed the same. I mean, he dramatically cut his strikeout rate, in both Double A and in High A. So I feel you on the Rockies' crowded infield right now, but at the same time, they don't really have a first baseman, consider it, unless you think they're going to move Ian Desmond there full-time. This is LeMahieu's contract year. I'm still not the biggest Trevor Story believer in the world, and I don't say that because I think McMahon can play short, but just because I still think that might be Rogers' eventual home. Mm-hmm. So it's not crazy for me to think he could get 250 to 300 plate appearances this year and then closer to a full slate next year.
I think he might be the likely first baseman as of right now. I mean, it's early, but I think that's what I had heard. Yeah. To support your point.
Yeah. I guess I was going to say, I'm just a little bit worried about, I think platoon issues are still something he might have to deal with, mm-hmm. but, overall, I mean, tough not to like his proximity and his floor and obviously the contextual factors.
Yeah, and I'm just going to stick with you, Ben. I just want you to talk to me about Taylor Trammell because I love him.
He's pretty fast.
Yeah.
And he was extremely – I mean, he went from honorable mention last year to 28, so that's pretty good. I was impressed by how much he walked last year. I know the strikeout rate was above 20%, but he also walked 12.4% of the time. And 41 steals is pretty good. So yeah. I don't think he'll have that smooth. Like, I think someone's going to slow him down eventually. I don't know if he's going to skyrocket from this, you know, right to crushing Double A or anything. But so far, so good.
Yeah, I agree. Brett. Sixto Sanchez is obviously a very popular name at Baseball Prospectus. You have him at 30, Walker Buehler 31. I think it's an interesting contrast, because obviously it indicates that Sanchez has more ceiling, given that Buehler is going to be in the majors this year. How much more ceiling does Sanchez have? Like, what can he do that Buehler can't? Because Buehler is pretty damn good too.
Start. I mean, it's flip, but I think Sanchez has sort of the myth of the body working against him, because he's small, but he has he certainly has the repertoire of a starting pitcher, and he's got the command and control profile as he moves up. Buehler, I think he's going to get chances to start. I think it's strange to say, because they are a couple of levels apart, and they're physically they're very different, but I think Sanchez has a noticeably better chance to be a starting pitcher long term than Buehler does, and that's sort of where the earnings come in.
Why do you think he has a better chance to start? That's interesting to me. Just Arsenal? Buehler was like talked about, he's a four pitch guy.
Yeah, it's more command, and I think he has a large risk of sort of falling into the first Carlos Martinez trap, where he starts to get used as a reliever first before he ends up getting a long chance to start. And Martinez was able to work out of that, but not everybody does.
Sure. Yeah. There's Neftali Feliz guys like
that. The Dodgers are weird the way they use pitchers and how they have so many pitchers. So
yeah,
even though it's
no
great,
argument on the weirdness. Yeah.
It's great that he's a Dodger in some way, because obviously high potential for wins, good ballpark, but in other ways he might have a better ranking if he was, I don't know, I'm trying to think of a team with a good park, but that doesn't do this type of like really weird
the
stuff.
Royals?
But the Royals are about to be bad. I don't know. Don't listen to me. Just go on. Maybe it's weird to say, but maybe like the Angels now, because they seem like they're gonna be decent.
Sure. I think my counter would be that the Dodgers have traded away actually a decent amount of, they've traded away at least three potential starters this year and didn't sign anyone noticeably. So I think he actually has a decent chance, but I do agree that there's a very good chance he spends at least part of the year in the bullpen. So I certainly understand that. I just look at it, Sixto is 6 foot, 185. Buehler 6'2". He is skinny, so there is that working against him. But it's just because we talk about obviously pitchers a lot and how we avoid them, and it would seem to me Sixto has at least equal risk, if not more, just given the gap and how hard he throws and the stature and all of that. But it's one spot, so it does not really matter. Ben, can Joe Adell jump really high?
No. No, I think that I'm very confident in saying that we will never see Joe Adell jump very high.
Yeah, he's got like George Costanza type liftoff. It's disappointing.
Remember when we played hoops in Brett's backyard?
Yes.
And I showed off my 3-inch vertical? It's basically like that.
I'm going to put this out there on the record. Do you remember when I dunked a lot?
Dunked is, I believe it was a seven foot hoop.
Okay, sure. I'm not. Yeah. But come on. That's unexpected for me.
Yes, it was. We'll leave it at that.
Yeah. Let's okay. We can move on. So JB Crawford checks in at 36, obviously another kind of safety guy. You have him as a 5-category contributor, but no impact categories. I'm not here to disagree with that. I guess my question is, how much are you buying into, or does this indicate that you're not buying into kind of the power outburst that he showed after some swing changes and his hands got healthy because he had injured his hands a little bit last year. And in the second half, he really did hit for power. Is that a sign that are you regressing to the mean a little bit there, or is it a lack of belief? What's driving that?
No, I think it's actually the opposite. I mean, the impact power is really meant to be about 30 homers. I don't see Crawford as a 30 homer guy, but I think I'm pretty confident in him being a 20 homer guy at this point going forward. I don't think he's going to add a ton of steals to it. I think it'll be enough that it'll help a little bit. And, you know, the batting average is kind of going to be the same thing. I don't think it's going to be great, but I don't think it's going to hurt you. I think power is going to be his biggest contributor, honestly, going forward. Yeah. And that's a, you know, speaking of being in good situations, I mean, that Philly is a nice place to hit anyway. So I do think the power is pretty real, just not, you know, not that real.
Yeah, so let's stay in Philly. Jorge Alfaro is at 38. How weird was it to write Jorge Alfaro and then put him with a low risk factor?
Right. it's weird, but it both is and it isn't. I mean, he's going to play in 2018, and yes, there is lots of contact risk and plate discipline risk, and he's not a finished product behind the plate either, but you look at his stat lines as he's made his way up the minors, they're really pretty consistent.
Yep.
Which is so strange for a player that we think of as being as wide variance as Alfaro. Yeah. I think it's a good way to sort of dial back what we think the risk is. I think even the bad version of Alfaro is still probably a 250 hitter with, you know, 15 to 20 homers. So
that brings me to kind of my next point is so you have him as a potential $15 to $20 earnings guy. How little does he have to do to justify the low end of that? Let's say $15. What does he have to do to be a $15 catcher?
He's gotta hit 260 and he's gotta hit between 20 and 25 homers.
Okay. I think that, yeah. Ben, am I out of line in thinking that's like more the likelihood of what he's going to be than anything? And that doesn't disagree with the way you ranked him or the potential earnings, to be clear. I'm just, that feels like kind of maybe even a slightly optimistic outlook for Alfaro.
You're asking me to be the low man on Alfaro?
I'm not asking you to be low. What do you think Alfaro is going to be? I mean, we took him in RDI. We both like him. But like, yeah. Realistically, what are you expecting from a full season of Jorge Alfaro?
Like 255, 21 homers.
Okay, so that's actually lower than what Brett just said.
Well, right? I meant now.
Okay. All right.
Do you want like what I think his prime season will be?
Yeah. So let's say 3 years from now, he's already 24.
Yeah. Right. I think. Alfaro's best season could have him flirting with 30 homers. Okay. And, you know, maybe the average gets up to 275 or something.
Yeah. Okay. So Ben, I'll stick with you on a guy I know I love. I forget where you're at on him. Jermai Jones at 39. Interesting little thing came out today that he might be seeing some time, at least in spring training, at second base. Does that do anything for you? Does it really change much? I mean, what type of impact could that have if he can even fake it there to get fantasy eligibility?
Then he'd be a run first middle infield prospect, so I'd probably have him in my top seven.
Okay, and Brett, like how much does that move the needle for you? I mean, I'm not taking it as a serious. I think we're going to see him there in spring training. I don't think that makes it at all likely he's going to see any real time there, but
Yeah,
I guess honestly, I'm wondering, like, how interested should we be in this?
Even if they came out and said they're committing to playing Jones at second base the entire 2018 season, I really don't think it would move him much. I mean, I think the position, the difference between the positions has really flattened over the last couple of years.
Yeah.
Outfield is certainly not significantly deeper than second base anymore, and you could make the argument, depending on your league size, that second base might be a deeper position than outfield.
If you've got five outfield spots and some utilities, it gets thin awful quick.
Yes. Anytime someone hints at multi-eligibility, that's always a little fun, but you can't bet on that from a prospect. And, you know, if we knew he was a second baseman, I don't think I'd push him to be ranked much higher than this.
Okay. I'm trying to think of the next grouping here. I mean, I'm not trying to go one by one, but 40 and 41 are Alex Verdugo and Austin Meadows. And to me, Ben, they feel like two outfielders that I honestly just don't even know what to do with them, but for very different reasons. Is this ranking kind of indicative of you're not sure kind of what they're going to be, or is it like more of a strong belief that they're just okay?
For Verdugo, it's a strong belief that he's just okay. For Meadows, it's a shruggy face. It didn't really feel right to put Meadows lower than this, just because he's going to see the majors this year, assuming he can stay healthy. And he does still have, you know, some power speed capability, but mm-hmm. It also felt weird putting him behind Verdugo, because I'm like very sure Verdugo is going to be a major league starter, and I'm less sure about Meadows. So it kind of more started with the Verdugo ranking, and then I felt like we had to sort of anchor Meadows to him, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. It does. Brett, Monty Harrison, now with the Marlins, a longtime favorite of mine. I think it's just interesting because like you said before, when we talked about the intro, you know, when you put these dollar values down, when you put the overviews and the potential impact down, it really kind of reinforces where you have some of these guys. I've always liked Harrison, but I think it's accurate to say that he's more of like a potential 2020 guy, maybe a 2025 guy in that sense. And I guess obviously the steals are valuable in today's world, but I guess this is less about Harrison and the list itself and more about like how valuable are these 2020 guys these days? Because I feel like there's, you, given the rise in power, it's just not as appealing as it once was.
Yeah, it's both the good and the bad, right? Your 20 steal guys are fewer and further between, but literally everybody hits 20 home runs now.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, what really sets those players apart is the batting average. You know, you have your potential 2020 guys who can hit 250, and you have your potential 2020 guys who can hit 300. And that in this context really makes all of the difference. You know, I would argue that the players that are capable of stealing 20 to 25 bases, and Ben, this is right up your alley. You know, you'd rather have those players be stronger batting average contributors than power contributors, just because batting average is something that is not as easy to find. And, you know, we're seeing guys who we think are 5 to 10 homer bats hitting 20 homers now. So, you know, if you take a, you know, I'm trying to think of a good example of this. You know, scrolling 10 spots down the list, Jesse Winker isn't a terrible example of this.
I was told not to talk about Jesse Winker.
That's fine. So Winker is a guy who might just be a 10 to 15 home run guy. And that's okay. And in this environment, especially in his home park, it would not surprise me if he hit 20 home runs. So, you know, you're talking about the upside in a particular category that there just is not in other categories because of the nature of the game.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Ben, Michael Chavis, top 50, he checks in at 48. This is obviously fantasy and real life are different. This is markedly different from kind of the real life aspects of, or I guess the real life rankings of Chavis and what's expected of him. I'm not sure that I would have labeled him as a guy who would necessarily stand out in a fantasy list as different from a real life list. So what was the thought process behind landing him, you know, as a top 50 guy?
Partially, I didn't agree with the decision to leave him off the real top 101.
Sure.
I don't think
he
needs to be.
That's fine.
Don't think he needs to be top 50, but I think there are plenty of guys in the last, you know, 20, 25 spots I would take him over easy. I mean, he's obviously not going to be a third baseman if he stays with the Red Sox because of Devers, but even if he ends up at first base or left field, obviously it's a great park to hit in. It's shaping up to be a very good lineup now that Martinez is on board and a lot of these guys are starting to come of age, and I do think he'll get some playing time. I mean, I guess it's harder for him to get playing time this year now that we know everything. This ranking came out before sort of some of the more recent free agent acquisitions. So
sure.
I don't think his upside is crazy, but I do think he is going to legitimately hit for power at the major league level. And if he does get traded, yes, he loses the contextual factors, but I think he can hack into third base for a few years. And I also think like this is really when the list starts to thin out. I think if we had him 10 spots earlier, it would look kind of crazy, but you know, I'm looking at the guys around him and none of them jump out to me as substantially really better than him either.
Yeah. Okay. So one last question for you, Ben. Who is the CJ Cron of the top 50?
I think that would be Enya because she only has one real hit. Welcome back to episode 101 of Tino. We're now going to take you through the second half of the top 101 with a little more alacrity than we hit on those first 50 names, starting by skipping Jesse Winker, who's at 51. No one is allowed to talk about Jesse Winker on Tino anymore. So, Craig, back to you, and we'll start at 52, which is Anthony Alford.
Yeah, I really like him, but we're actually just going to keep on moving. I wanted to talk to Ben about Jason Groom. I know it's Grum, but we're not doing that again. Obviously there's a lot of faith in him and keeping him, you know, top 60 name. It was a rough year, but there are a lot of kind of contextual factors around that. He's not the first pitcher in the back half of the top 50. Is he the highest ceiling pitcher in the back half of the top 101? I'm sorry.
Maybe. I mean, we have Grom, Hunter Green, and Baz ranked back to back to back here, and their ceilings and floors are all exactly the same. So for all of their ceilings, it says our number one pitching prospect in 2020, and realistic floor is most pitching prospects. Green, I think, has maybe the most built-in rankings resiliency here, because if he fails this year, you know, I could see us brushing that aside, sort of like how we're seeing Grom, how we brush aside Grom's here. If Grom is bad again or hurt again, he's going to fall like a rock. He might not even be a top 101 prospect next year. And then Baz, you know, a lot of the reports on Baz have been very promising. I know there are people who prefer him to Hunter Green. I think that is a little aggressive. But all of these guys, you know, probably will go 0-3 because they're pitchers, but all of these guys have potential to, you know, rank where Reyes and Kopech ranked this year eventually, which was 11 and 12, I believe.
Yeah, or at least in that Honeywell Mitch Keller range, which is, you know, they, I think they were about 10 spots back, but probably not really substantially different. Brett, Miguel Andujar has gotten a lot of attention. The Yankees did just acquire Brandon Drury. Obviously, that was after this list was published. Does that put a damper on the Andujar buzz for you?
It does a little bit. I think he'll still get the opportunity to try to push himself into a more long-term role. I mean, Drury can play second base while Torres, you know, gets a couple of a month or so of at bats in the minors, and if he hits, you know, I don't necessarily think Drury is a guy who needs to play every day, especially on the Yankees. So he'll have an opportunity. I mean, obviously, the more leash he would have had, the better chance he would have had of sticking. But I don't think it was ever realistic that he was going to have a huge leash in New York anyway.
Fair enough. I'm going to stick with you, Brett. Hylan Ortiz at number 63. One of the bigger ceiling floor gaps, although we're certainly in the range where there are a bunch of those, but ceiling you have as a power-based outfield two. Floor is the last time he'll ever be ranked, which is and you put the risk factor as extreme, obviously, but there are people kind of hopping on the bandwagon already. Is this kind of the last chance to get in on the ground floor? Did we miss the ground floor on Hylan Ortiz?
No, I don't think you've missed it. But yeah, this is going to be one of the last opportunities to jump on. I mean, as with any Phillies prospects, I think, there'll still be some opportunity to move while he's in A-ball. But if he is the guy we think he is, once he gets to Reading, all bets are off. I mean, he might hit 50 homers in Reading if they stick him there a whole season. And he's the guy who he showed glimpses of in Williamsport. I just, the bat could be really good. A lot of power, a strong hit tool, and the ability to tap into it. Good approach. Everything, pretty much everything you want except steals.
Yeah, absolutely. Ben, I'm going to skip down to 70 and Austin Riley. Obviously a monster year coming off of 2016, which was, you know, I felt like people were relatively down on him despite being pretty young and in full season ball, got to double A at age 20. If he does more of the same, and I'm not going to say it's going to be exactly the same, because again, it was, you know, 315, 389, 511 at double A at age 20. But even if there's some regression there, where do you see him next year? Like how big a prospect is he? Because he's in a loaded system, and you know, this is not, I wouldn't say this is a ranking that's down on him, but I certainly think, you know, there are going to be people there saying there's a lot more ceiling to be had than we're giving him credit for, I guess.
I don't think we had one player who moved in the rankings more often than Riley. Is that true, Brett? I think he might be the single player with the hardest time ranking.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure like our conversations over the last 2 weeks before we published this were something about another player, and then me going, I think we should move Austin Riley up, and then something about another player, and then I think we should move Austin Riley.
Yeah, he moved up like three spots every day for 9 days or something like that. I don't know, man. I'm really torn on him. I acknowledge what he did last year. I mean, the double A stats to me almost aren't real. His BABIP was almost 400. Mm-hmm. And the high A stats were nowhere near as good, although, you know, for his age, still.
For his age and the FSL, which is
relevant. Yeah,
but certainly not nearly the same.
So he's just a guy who makes me wish I still saw these people in person more. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Just because, like, it's so hard to know how to know what to make of a profile like this. I think the disparity in his ranking next year compared to now could be huge, right? If he does very well in double A, he could be a top 30 prospect next year. If if the approach doesn't get any better, it wouldn't surprise me if he's, you know, honorable mention or maybe in one of those last 10 slots or something like that. So I'm fully aware that we have to just sort of wait and see is not a very satisfying answer if you're listening to this podcast, but I don't really know what else to do with Riley other than wait and see how he hits.
Yeah, that's fair. So Brett, this next section of which there's no theme, it is the seventh tier, has two guys that I yelled at you about in Luis Garcia and Adrian Morejon. Now, we've definitely mentioned Garcia before. I know Ben talked about him during the shortstop segment that we did, but what is it? I'm going to say I talked to you off the ledge, but it was less of a talking and more of an, you know, like an aggressive growl or something. But what is it that has you so hyped up on Luis Garcia? Like, why did you have him in the 50s?
It's a couple of things. One, it's like all of these other guys that are, you know, 17, 18 pre full season. It's the tools. I mean, the hit tool is really good. He's fast. He can steal bases. There's power potential. Not like he's not going to be like a 30 homer guy, but there's enough power potential that he's not going to be a, you know, a 5 to 10 homer guy. I think he can get the 15 to 20 range, especially with the quality of the contact he can make. So that's one. Two is the level of performance at his age that he showed last year, which sort of hints at, you know, the ability to really get a jump start on his career. You know, the Nats tend to be pretty aggressive with assignments, especially for some of their international guys. I don't think they're going to move him to full season ball necessarily this year to start, but I think he will end up there. Mm-hmm. And he'll be he'll be 18 all season long. I think he's from, I know he's 17 now, and I'm spacing on where his page is as I'm scrolling through this. Yes, he will. He won't turn 18 until the middle of May. He'll start the season at 17. So it's those two things. Plus, you know, there's one, it's the fact that he's another Nationals, prominent in, you know, international signing. We talk about not buying too much into the organizational stuff, but, you know, it's a point to take into consideration. I mean, we joke about it all the time about how, you know, you need to stay away from Orioles pitching prospects and Mariners hitting prospects, and they're
any Mariners prospect.
Yeah, and they're all sort of, you know, it's the old trope that they're stereotypes because they're true, but you know, the Nationals have a reputation now of getting these real high upside guys that into their system that, you know, that are being, you know, slightly overlooked. Garcia was certainly not overlooked in his J2 mm-hmm. class. He was, I think BA had him as the second or third ranked guy in the 2016 class. Mm-hmm. But it's you know, there are other intangibles that, like, he did the Heimer Candelario thing where he was actually born in New York and then moved to the Dominican. Mm-hmm. And got signed as an international guy. So you know, I think, you know, even just in terms of progressing earlier in his career, I think there's going to be less of a less of an adjustment period for him. He's, you know, all that I've heard has been he's a very high IQ baseball. It, pretty much everything you want to read about a prospect.
Brett, I'm about to hit the wrap it up box. This has been like 4 minutes long.
You asked me about Luis Garcia. What the fuck did you expect?
I'm just, do you have a summation thing?
Yeah, he's really good. Buy him now before he blows up.
Okay. I would also note that Alex Reyes did the thing where he was born in the U.S. and moved to the Dominican. Ben, in a shorter, I'm going to give you an opportunity to expound on a guy you really like, I believe. Tell me if I'm wrong, but maybe in fewer words than Brett, Garrett Hampson checked in at 84.
I'm pretty sure he can hit and run.
Oh, and where does he play?
He plays in the middle infield, Craig.
Yeah,
he plays in the middle infield. That's sure good. Is.
Ben, I want to stick with you. So just starting with tier seven, which is Luis Garcia, settle down, Brett, on down. Who is your highest, like who do you like best as a pitching prospect? Obviously, like this is in an order, but assuming you differ a little bit from Brett and there are some compromises here, who's your favorite, I guess I should say high upside pitching prospect of the guys in the back 25 here?
It's probably Luis Garcia, who I really like.
Oh, wow. Because you like him on the map.
Yeah. Who do I like most out of the high upside arms? So that's basically Cease, Baez. You could argue Alcantara, really.
Maybe Romero. Yeah.
Where? Who?
Seth Romero. Potentially.
Oh, the whole rest of the list.
Back 25 guys. Sorry.
I got stuck on that tier. That's classic.
No worries.
None of them. No, I'm intrigued by Baez just because of the reports. Like, you know, our ceiling and floor was he's 70 spots too high here, he's 70 spots too low here. Obviously, I just switched that. But he's a guy I'm really interested in watching more. I would say Cease if I wasn't pretty sure he was going to be a reliever. But if he is able to sort of – you know, I wrote this one and I put his realistic ceiling as Lance McCullers Jr., who's another guy who, you know, I think we would have put better than 50-50 odds on McCullers being a reliever. And he was able to figure out and stay on the mound. So if Cease is somehow able to figure it out, my answer would be him. But assuming Cease does move to the pen, I think it's Baez.
Yeah, I'm just disappointed you didn't go with Lance McCullers Jr. I know it's right there. Just Ben, similar question, but highest, your favorite high upside bat in the back, you know, from 90. So tier eight is starts at 90, onto the rest of the list. Who do you like the most there?
I've already talked about Badu a bunch, so I'll go with Khalil Lee instead. I really like the power speed upside, obviously. There are some approach and hit tool issues, and yes, that sinks more prospects than I care to admit. But, you know, he's another in a long line of really toolsy potential power and speed outfielders. So definitely a guy I'm going to have some fun watching this year.
Brett, I'm just going to throw you the same two questions. Back 25, favorite high upside arm, and back, you know, 11, high upside bat.
I'm really excited to see what Jesus Luzardo does this year. I think
the Jesus Lizard.
I think there is a non-zero chance that he is the top left-handed pitching prospect in baseball at the end of 2018. And I think he could do some very special things if, you know, he takes that next step forward in his next year back from Tommy John. You know, that kind of ties in with the whole, you know, the Nationals know what they're doing. I mean, he's not on the Nationals anymore, but they did pluck him out of the draft after Tommy John, and that seems to be an awfully good gamble at this point. In terms of hitter, I will talk very quickly about two guys because I'm gonna cheat. One is Esturi Ruiz. I will actually, Craig, do you want me to kick it to you so you can talk about him? Because I'll have a different guy, but why don't you talk about Ruiz and why we are right on him?
Yeah, and then Ben can tell us why we're wrong. He's a smaller guy. I don't think he's that different than Luis Garcia from a fantasy context.
Shut your whore mouth.
I'd have them much closer together, which probably involves Ruiz being a little bit higher and Garcia being a bit lower. But middle infield, obviously Garcia has the shortstop aspect, which I think definitely gives him a little more safety. But, you know, Brett and I were looking at video of Ruiz, and it's he's small of frame right now, but I think he can add a little strength, and he has the speed to be a factor on the base paths. His swing is very torque heavy right now, and the bat speed is there to create the power despite, you know, not that big of a frame. And he still has bat control despite how torqued up his swing is, and how much bat speed there is, which is the thing you usually worry about. Like, are they going all for bat speed and not going to be able to make any contact? But he really, it's still very raw right now, but that's kind of what you get when the guy is in rookie ball. So I don't know. I love the upside. I think he can contribute pretty much across the board. I know you put impact potential in four different categories. That's something I'm very interested in a guy in the 90s. You know what I mean? So Ben, why am I wrong? Why are Brett and I wrong, I should say?
Well, if anything, I would think that you would want an estuary closer to a marsh. Oh my
God. Yeah. That's fair. That's fair. And Marsh was, where was Marsh?
Two spots behind.
Behind? Oh, God, I thought he was higher. God damn it. All right, well, I'm going to have to move on from that. Brett, who is the guy that you like?
I want to talk about Colton Wilker, who comes in at 99. I think we have to be a little bit careful, because I think some people are getting a little too excited about Wilker. But, he is... You know, he is one of the guys who has one of the better hit tools in the minors right now. And he's going to be he's in the Colorado system. He's going to be playing in a lot of very hitter friendly minor league parks. I think there's obviously a question as to how much power there is. But I think the hit tool is going to allow him to, tap pretty well into the power that he does have. There's a certain bump that all Rockies prospects get, and he's starting to get it now. But he is someone who could certainly grow into the hype that he is starting to get, even though he might be overhyped now.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And he is he was number 99. You threw Anderson Espinosa on at 100. I applaud you for keeping him in people's minds, but as far as I'm concerned, I guess we're done with the list.
Well, so are you sure you don't want to run through that again?
Yeah, yes, I am sure. Do you want to take that? Go ahead. What's that?
You know who's extremely not on this list?
Who's that?
That would be Nick Solak.
Oh. That's true. He is extremely not on this list.
No, else is. I'm pretty sure Anthony Banda is not on this.
No,
is
not certainly on this not
list either.
Not a single Diamondback on this list. In fact,
that's not true. Is it? No. No, you're right. It's not true.
I would imagine it would only be John Duplantier, and he is not there.
He is not on this list. No.
Yeah. Anyway, I was just trying to say the Rays are trash, and all their moves make me make me extremely happy that their offseason philosophy now matches their garbage fire of a home ballpark. They're not a real baseball team. I compared them on Twitter to the Bengals without the brief period of quasi-success, and it just makes me very happy to see all the people who, try so hard to defend every single one of their moves now just spin themselves in circles as the Rays sell off anybody who makes more than $9 an hour. But, they signed Carlos Gomez, so really I'm sure there's some extra 2% angle here that we don't fucking understand. Not the fact that they're just gutting this team once again, but gut away. I hope they trade Chris Archer to someone else, even though I don't really like Chris Archer either. But you know when I will like Chris Archer? When he's not a Ray. So it's going well for me. Everyone's like, well, yeah, but that means the Yankees got Brandon Drury. I don't care. I like the Yankees way more than I like the Rays. Fuck Dan Johnson, and this makes me happy.
So does that make Vontaze Burfict Elijah Dukes? Is that the corollary there?
Jesus Christ! Wow, that got aggressive. I do think Andy Dalton is Ben Zobrist.
Okay, sure.
I'm letting you take this one. I'm not even gonna say any. Oh, fuck. Episode 101 of Tino. As always, we'll send you out with a little housekeeping. Please rate and review us on iTunes and Stitcher. We only had a very few people leave us comments and send us screenshots to apply for the Avisail Garcia 2XL.
Over 2 weeks, too.
Right. So this is we can't really be mad at our listeners for not being attentive, because we're not attentive and we're the ones doing the podcast. So I'll give everybody one more week, but if no one else submits, I guess we're just going to have a draw between like three or four people, and that'll be fun. You can follow us on Twitter at Tino Podcast and get in touch with us through email at tinopodcast@gmail.com. You can find Brett on Twitter at BrettSayerBP. You can find Craig at CD. That's CD as in...
couldn't deliver.
Goldstein. You can find our producer, George, at George Bissell. And you can find me at Van Carsley. Thank you for listening, and have a good night, unless you are a Rays fan.
Hey guys, do you think Enya could trim payroll without getting worse?